From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Last Tuesday in Kenosha, Wisconsin, police enclosed in armored vehicles clear people from a street during a protest for Jacob Blake. The night has already been filled with tense confrontations. The vehicle approaches a local service station. There, a group of men with military-style weapons surround the building. A few are on the roof, and they tell the police that they're protecting the building.
Hey, we're guarding it! It's ours! We got it!
A few moments later, the police drive in the direction of the protesters. As they do, they address the armed vigilante group again.
Hey, thank you, guys. Need water? Seriously. Guys, we're all right. We need water.
We need water.
We'll throw you one.
Thank you.
All right, come on, guys. Let's get out of here.
The video captures police throwing water bottles out of the vehicle and to the armed vigilante group. We appreciate you guys. We really do, the police say. Minutes later, gunshots ring out, and video captures one of the members of the group, 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, holding and shooting an AR-15-style rifle. He's subsequently been charged with the murder of two protesters. And it appears that that night, police let Rittenhouse walk away. Well, it's one of many videos and pictures pulsing through the infosphere right now. Police tear-gassing protesters, but standing by when armed vigilantes show up. Law enforcement fist-bumping far-right-wing militia members at rallies. But do those individual moments coalesce into a cohesive whole? How should people make sense of what they're seeing? So this hour on Point, we're going to explore that question. What is the relationship between political rhetoric, law enforcement, and militia, vigilante groups, and far-right-wing groups in America? And we will get back to what happened in Kenosha in just a minute, but first we need to start in Portland, Oregon, where police have identified the victim of Sunday's shooting there. They say 39-year-old Aaron Danielson died of a gunshot wound to the chest. And photos of the scene from Sunday show that Danielson was wearing a hat with the insignia of the group Patriot Prayer. Well, Jonathan Levinson of Oregon Public Broadcasting joins us now with more. Jonathan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, this shooting happened there this weekend. What more do we know? Has there been any more information that's come out about Danielson, or do the police know or have a suspect in mind about who might be the shooter?
The police have stayed pretty tight-lipped about suspects. We're starting to learn more about Danielson. His friend spoke yesterday, described him as funny and quick-witted. They said he loved his community and being a Portlander, and they also pleaded with people to stay calm and not, no retribution and to renounce violence. Like you mentioned, we also know that he was affiliated with Patriot Prayer. That is a far-right group that's based just outside of Portland, and they frequently come into the city to demonstrate, and they, those demonstrations often involve violence. The group's leader, Joey Gibson, described Danielson as a, quote, friend and supporter of the group.
So Patriot Prayer comes into the city frequently. Have they been there over the past 3 months? Because protests have been going on every night in Portland for the entire summer, practically.
Yeah. So there's the bigger context here is that Portland has sort of been this epicenter of these, left-right clashes for the past about 4 years. They've largely stayed out of the way, though, the past 95 days, I guess we're on now. And it's only been the past couple of weeks that they've started to emerge and be a bigger presence in Portland during these protests. There was a big demonstration 2 weeks ago, and then this one this past weekend, both, devolved into a good deal of violence. But other than that, they've been so sort of surprising to a lot of us observers that they stayed out of the way up until now.
Okay. So can you tell me more about what we know about what Patriot Prayer, the group, stands for? You said they're far right wing, but do they have sort of a clear set of guiding principles, or what do they say they stand for?
Joey Gibson is very religious. He preaches a lot of religious ideology. Sort of your standard far-right conservative principles that they'll come out and demonstrate for, small government staying out of the way and things along those lines.
Mm-hmm. And you know, have you mentioned the clash between was it between Patriot Prayer and protesters a couple of weeks ago?
The 2 weeks ago, there was a pro-police, pro-Trump demonstration. The Proud Boys were actually a big presence at that one. That is this, they call themselves a chauvinist organization. They're notorious around the country for going to demonstrations and initiating violence. That was, hundreds of demonstrators came to downtown that weekend. And for about 3 hours, it devolved into really extraordinary violence. There was fist fights. There was, you know, bear mace going back and forth and paintball guns. A lot of the pro-police demonstrators were armed with rifles and handguns. At one point, one of them actually pulled out a handgun and was pointing it at the crowd. It was really alarming amounts of violence that just was allowed to go on for hours.
Allowed to go on. So tell me more, what were Portland police doing at the time?
Yeah. So, I forget what day of the protest that was. I think day somewhere in the 80s, but you know, the most nights police declare unlawful assemblies or riots with the racial justice protesters and then disperse the crowd. You know, they have batons, they use impact munitions, many nights they use tear gas. And during this demonstration, which they themselves described as meeting the definition of a riot, they were nowhere to be seen. You know, you could hear them from a couple blocks away making announcements on the loudspeaker, urging people to stay peaceful. But they said later that they just didn't have the manpower to disperse the crowd.
They didn't have the manpower. Okay, so that's interesting. So you have been reporting on the protests in Portland for a long time. I mean, in general, especially over the past couple of weeks, as you've been saying, when these right-wing groups have been coming into the city, what have police been doing? Because, of course, over the course of the summer, you know, the rest of the nation was watching as police and federalized officers were tear gassing and shooting rubber bullets at Black Lives Matter protesters. So what have police been doing as the right wing groups have been coming into the city?
Not much. Local police agencies actually blocked intersections for the Trump rally as it drove into Portland from outside the city. And they were initially blocking the vehicles from entering downtown, sort of keeping them on their pre-planned route on the freeway around the city. And then suddenly, I was standing there and I watched the police, you know, started letting the vehicles stream across this bridge into downtown. And that led to hundreds of demonstrators clogging downtown, getting into fights. You know, they were spraying bear mace from the beds of their pickup trucks, shooting people with paintball guns. They have largely stayed out of the way this past weekend and the weekend before that. As you know, like I said, a lot of violence is playing out during the dueling demonstrations.
Well, have you had a chance to talk to Portland police about why they're staying out of the way? I mean, what's their view of the right-wing groups coming into the city now?
They say that they are very understaffed. They have a big shortage right now. I'm going to mess up the number. They had about 50 retirements in August. They have another 100 officers, I believe it is 100, who are either in training or still on probation. And they've shifted a lot of their staffing to the nights to deal with the 90 some odd days of racial justice protests. So they say that, you know, they're understaffed and they just don't have the ability to devote the resources to this that is necessary. They will also say that, you know, a lot of times when we talk about these types of dueling demonstrations, there's only one side of the protest, they say, that attack the police. They say that they try to communicate with demonstration organizers before and during demonstrations to ensure that things stay peaceful, and that there's only one side that will actually talk to them, and that makes it much harder. But like I said, you know, watching all of these play out from the sidelines, just as an observer, there is an enormous discrepancy in how they respond to the two groups, even on the scene right there. I mean, I heard one story of last weekend. Demonstrators drove their trucks through a group of protesters, and sitting on the side in a police vehicle, one of them sort of got on the microphone and said, "See, told you guys to stay out of the street."
Well, and here we are in a situation where As of this weekend, one person has been killed, a member of the Patriot Prayer Group, one of these right-wing groups. So the violence has taken a life, and the Portland police, as far as I'm hearing, Jonathan, don't yet have a suspect in that shooting. So we'll see what continues to unfold in Portland. But Jonathan Levinson of Oregon Public Broadcasting, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so I want to turn now to Michael German. He's a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program. He's a former special agent with the FBI who in the early 1990s went undercover with right-wing extremist groups. And he's the author of a new report from the Brennan Center, Hidden in Plain Sight, Racism, White Supremacy, and Far-Right Militancy in Law Enforcement. Michael German, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So we've got about a minute and a half before we have to take the first break here. But how do you make sense of what happened in Portland over the weekend?
It's hard to make sense of because tactically, it's really dangerous what the police are doing. On the one hand, giving far-right militants the freedom to act out violently will attract the most violent people to the protests. And if the police aren't protecting the public from those violent far-right militants, you can only expect them to start relying on self-help and protecting themselves. So I don't understand the tactics, and it seems to just increase this spiral of violence that will only get worse if the police don't act appropriately.
Well, obviously, there's a lot more to talk about when we come back, especially what you have in your report, Michael German. So we are trying to make sense or understand how to make sense of all the reports and imagery of police interaction with right-wing militia groups and armed vigilantes in cities across America. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're trying to figure out how to understand all the reports and images that people have been seeing over the summer of police interaction with far right-wing groups, with armed vigilantes and members of militias who have also come into the streets as counter-protesters, as Black Lives Matter protesters and Americans, millions of Americans protesting against police violence have taken to the streets across the summer months. And I'm joined today by Michael German. He is a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, focused on law enforcement and intelligence oversight and reform. He's also a former FBI special agent who went undercover with far right-wing groups in the 1990s. And he's author of a new report just out from the Brennan Center titled Hidden in Plain Sight, Racism, White Supremacy, and Far-Right Militancy in Law Enforcement. So, Michael German, let me just ask the big question review and see where we should begin this conversation, because people have been seeing these images that, you know, there's one that I think is floated around both the mainstream media and social media of, you know, cops fist bumping right wing militia groups, say in Georgia. That's just one of many examples. But is there a pattern to be drawn here of all the seemingly peaceful interactions that law enforcement has had with white right wing groups over the past several weeks or months?
There is certainly a pattern in a differentiation between how the police react to Black Lives Matter protests, the Standing Rock water protectors protests up in North Dakota, and groups perceived as either led by people of color or left-wing groups versus how they respond to much more serious violence at far right protests and rallies and basically planned riots. I mean, that's the part that has surprised me, is that this, you typically, and the Portland mayor made reference to the First Amendment rights of these groups, and I'm a First Amendment purist and would definitely support their rights to come and protest. The difference is here is we have their social media, and they're not talking about coming to protest, they're talking about coming to fight. And it's a handful of individuals who are the primary instigators, and it's easy to follow them and follow the violence. It's fascinating because the reporters know who they all are. So they follow them around and sure enough have captures images of them instigating violence throughout the protest. And yet somehow they're able to walk right past the police and go home with very little enforcement action taken. And then after they leave, you see the police come in and act very aggressively and violently towards the protesters that the far right militants attacked just minutes before. So go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the point and counterpoint that you just laid out is exactly, I think, what people want to know about, because you know, you heard Jonathan from Oregon Public Broadcasting earlier say that Portland police had been telling him that they're not using tear gas and rubber bullets against the far right wing groups because they were outnumbered, right? They just didn't have the manpower to deal with that riot or those riots in Portland. But of course, we have seen numbers not be an issue in many cities because tear gas, rubber bullets, armored vehicles, crowd control methods, all of these things have been regularly used across the summer for against other protesters. So what is holding back the police when it comes to these other groups? Is it a fear of rapidly escalating violence because these mostly men show up with heavy weaponry, or is it sympathy for their positions?
I'm afraid it's a little of both. It's interesting. The police basically make two excuses. The first, as you said, that they don't have enough resources to safely go in and address the violence at these daylight rallies where the far right militants engage in violence in plain sight. And second, that they don't want to escalate the violence that's there, which is a fascinating admission, right? That they know that their police actions escalate violence. But at night, they're perfectly happy to use those tactics and resources to escalate violence against lesser armed groups of protesters who aren't engaged in the same kind of deadly violence that the far right groups often engage in. So the argument acknowledges the problem that they're using their resources against less violent groups and that they recognize that their violent tactics often escalate the violence. You know, sometimes they'll say, well, these groups are heavily armed, so we realize that escalating the violence against them would be extremely dangerous, which is likely true, but is a horrible message to send to the public that if you come to a protest heavily armed, we'll leave you alone. But if you don't come armed, we're going to brutalize you with less lethal munitions and tear gas. It seems they're asking for a more violent response. And I do believe there is something to the polarization we've seen, the political polarization that affects our whole society, not just law enforcement, but certainly has an impact on law enforcement, where everybody's on one side or the other. And when the President of the United States deems anti-fascists as the enemy of his regime, and you know, obviously the police Trump is very popular in law enforcement, so they're on Team Trump against the anti-fascists, and they find themselves in the company of the far-right militants who, of course, are opposed to anti-fascism. So they just find themselves on the same side of the issue politically. And you do hear statements like the reporter from Portland who said, the police officer said over the radio after a truck tried to run into protesters, didn't we tell you to get out of the street? Rather than understanding that vehicle attacks in these protests have already killed three protesters. This is not something to be joked about. It is, certainly we don't want the police encouraging people in vehicles to run it at people in the street. And normally, in normal situations, they wouldn't. And certainly, they're using extreme violence against curfew violators and people who ignore dispersal orders at night. So why they would look at that potentially lethal violence as a joke is hard to understand. And it's hard to understand, again, what the tactic is. What is it the police are trying to accomplish by allowing this violence to escalate?
Yeah. Well, so there's lots of important things that you said that just then. We're going to get to discussing more about President Trump's role in political rhetoric in all of this. And I also just want to acknowledge that it seems like a big difference between now and, say, 30 years ago is the kind of weaponry that citizens have, right? I mean, like those AR-15 style rifles are basically military style rifles that citizens can have. And, they can point it at their fellow citizens. They can point it at police also. So there's a lot of firepower out there. But Michael German, I mean, the title of your report is Hidden in Plain Sight. So what is hidden in plain sight in American law enforcement?
So when I was an FBI agent in the early 90s, being asked to go undercover into neo-Nazi groups, one of the issues that we discussed was my personal safety, because it was known in law enforcement that there was sympathy for, there were individual officers who had sympathies for white supremacist causes and other far-right militant causes. So we had to discuss how we would limit a knowledge of the case within law enforcement. We were working on a joint terrorism task force, so other law enforcement agencies were involved. And, to be clear, I worked with a lot of really great officers from state and local police, not just on those cases, but cases throughout my career. But it's long been known in law enforcement that there are police officers who sympathize with these groups and associate with these groups. And this was borne out. There was a 2006 FBI internal report released through a Freedom of Information Act that was warning law enforcement about the infiltration of white supremacist groups into law enforcement and the self-recruitment of law enforcement officers into white supremacist organizations. So documentation of the warnings that I had received. And then in 2015, the FBI's counterterrorism policy guide warned the agents working domestic terrorism cases against white supremacists and far-right militants that police officers, that the subjects of their investigations, so domestic terrorism subjects, often have contact with law enforcement. So what it recommended was that the agents not put those subjects on the terrorist watch list, or put them on the list, but then mute them. There's a silent hit feature that allows, if a police officer searches for that person's name in the terrorist watch list, it wouldn't return anything to the police officer, but would alert the agent. And this is a really strange tactic, because the whole purpose of the terrorist watch list is to allow the broader law enforcement community to know who they're dealing with when they're dealing with somebody who the FBI thinks is a domestic terrorist. So to take them off the list is a very dangerous thing, because a police officer might come across them in some kind of altercation and not realize that they pose a dangerous threat. But because of the knowledge that police officers sympathetic to the white supremacist groups might use that access to alert those people they're under investigation, they forfeit the use of this important tool. So it's something that's been known in law enforcement and is recognized in law enforcement, but there's no national strategy to deal with it. There's nothing in those FBI reports that says the presence of white supremacist sympathizers in law enforcement is a threat to the public, is a threat to communities of color and others in the community, and we need to identify them and make sure that they are not capable of doing harm. There's nothing like that. It's just about how to protect FBI cases and personnel.
Huh. So my understanding, though, was that when you were doing that undercover work in the early 90s, that typically most of these far right-wing extremist groups, they were violently opposed to the federal government, at least, the power of the federal government, including federal law enforcement. Has that changed between then and now? Because we're seeing many of these groups, coming into cities or going to counter protests with the, waving the back the blue flag, or has there always been support for these right wing groups, support for local law enforcement?
It's interesting. The right wing milieu is there are very different groups have different ideologies and use different tactics, and so you can't make one universal statement about it. But there were some far right groups whose argument was that the federal government had no policing powers, so the only legitimate law enforcement authority were county sheriffs. And so there seemed to be some affinity for them, but it was very clear that when county sheriff's deputies were going out to arrest these people, they quickly became the enemy, and law enforcement has always been a significant target for these groups because they're the enforcement arm of the law. And that's been present forever. I mean, it's interesting. You just mentioned going back 30 years and the firepower was different, but the violence was the same. I'll remind you of the Greensboro Massacre, which was the same type of event where a group of anti-racists were out to protest the Klan, and the Klan showed up, and the police were nowhere to be seen, and a number of people were killed. In the 1990s when I worked, the tactics were better understood. We understood that the far right militants would intentionally pick places to go to have marches or rallies where they knew it would draw out political opposition, and they went there so they could attack their political opposition. The opposition would come to them, they could then attack them. And so the police would make sure that those instigators would not be allowed to cause trouble, that the police officers would be right there with them, that the first sign that they were breaking the law, they would be arrested and taken away. And what that did for the people that I was working against undercover, the hardcore violent white supremacists, they wouldn't go to public rallies because they knew that their likelihood of them getting identified and arrested was much higher. And what has changed under this administration, where the president has seemed to embrace these groups, is that the police have too. And I was shocked when I started seeing events all across the country, in Sacramento, in Huntington Beach, and ultimately in Charlottesville and in Portland, that the police were not reacting to this violence. Mm-hmm. And at first I thought, this excuse that, okay, they realized that they had made a mistake by not being in front of this thing, but rushing in wasn't going to make things better. But they would ultimately go around and arrest all the people who I could identify on Twitter videos who had committed illegal violence at these protests, but they didn't. And these individuals became prominent, they became mini celebrities in the movement, because they were captured on tape committing violence at a previous protest. And they would be invited to other protests where they could commit violence again. And it was really only until investigative journalists at ProPublica and Frontline produced a documentary about one of the groups that had traveled around the country and ultimately engaged in violence in Charlottesville that the FBI finally took notice of it. And a year after the events, issued indictments and won convictions. So that's the other question here, because as was discussed earlier in the program, many of the far-right militants that come into Portland to commit this violence are coming from out of state. So it's not just where's the Portland police here, where's the FBI and the federal law enforcement?
Yeah. Well, Michael German, stand by here for a second. We are talking about how to understand all the imagery and what we're seeing on the ground regarding interactions between law enforcement and far right-wing groups. When we come back, we'll talk more pointedly about how race factors into all of this. So we'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are exploring how to understand what the relationships are or might be between law enforcement or some members of American law enforcement and far right-wing extremist groups. I'm joined today by Michael German. He is a former special agent with the FBI in the early 1990s. He went undercover and infiltrated right-wing extremist groups in the United States. He's now with the Brennan Center and author of a new report titled Hidden in Plain Sight: Racism, White Supremacy, and Far-Right Militancy in Law Enforcement. Now, we started the hour playing that tape or sound from the video in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where police were seen throwing water bottles to the Kenosha Guard, a armed vigilante group. Included amongst that group was 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, who was subsequently charged with the shooting murder of two protesters in Kenosha. So there's something else about what has been happening in Kenosha that I think is worth exploring a little. So this takes us actually back to 2018, when Kenosha County Sheriff David Beth made some comments about a case involving shoplifting. The sheriff said, following the arrest of five suspects who had been arrested for allegedly shoplifting a Tommy Hilfiger outlet store, there was a high-speed chase after that. Four of the suspects were black, one was a minor. And in the wake of that chase and arrest, Sheriff David Beth said this.
Some point, we have to get to the point that we lock these people up. We have an agent assigned to each and every person that goes through the court system. And if they can't complete high school, if they get in trouble in high school, if they have a criminal record, if they do drive-by shootings, if they sell or give heroin to other people, if they come and steal thousands of dollars, if we don't think this costs society and the people of our community and our nation, if we don't think that that costs us billions of dollars, you're wrong. Let's put them in jail. Let's stop them from truly, at least some of these males going out and getting 10 other women pregnant and having small children. Let's put them away. At some point, we have to stop being politically correct. And I don't care what race, I don't care how old they are. If there's a threshold that they cross, these people have to be warehoused. No recreational time in the jails. We put them away. We put them away for the rest of their lives so that the rest of us can be better.
Now, we're playing Sheriff Beth's extended comments because his comments provide their own context here. So he went on and talked about why he believes the United States has a higher crime rate than other countries. And according to Sheriff Beth, again, this is in 2018, He said that one of the only solutions was harsher punishments.
In this country, in this community, in this state, we have to get to the point that we no longer will put up with the garbage people that fill our communities, that are our cancer to our society. The ones that do carjackings in Milwaukee. They go into a car while their child is in the back seat because it's running and they're filling it up with gas. These people are not an asset to society. These people just need to flat out go away. And I'm waiting for our lawmakers, our people, to really not stand for really what we're living with. And the riots, when someone gets shot by a police officer, I understand there's mistakes. I got it. But when a person comes out with a gun and a police officer shoots him and there's a walk, there's a riot, we got to take action on it. We got to take care of the people that are doing this.
That's Kenosha County Sheriff David Beth in 2018 in comments he made following a shoplifting case. He later on apologized for those comments and then again did so last week when the video resurfaced. Now, we played that because I want to introduce into the conversation LeFleur Stevens Dugan, a politics professor at Princeton University and author of Race to the Bottom: How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics. Professor Stevens Dugan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So Sheriff Beth made those comments. I mean, we've been talking about far right-wing political extremism in law enforcement, but Sheriff Beth's comments were made not in response to any political event, but to a shoplifting case in 2018. So what does that tell you about how powerfully race underlies these connections that we're trying to explore here?
I mean, I think it speaks to the power of race and many of these tropes that we see both politicians, but also law enforcement or, you know, someone's granddad at Thanksgiving. These are deep-seated stereotypes about criminality, particularly regarding Black males. And so he espoused what I think a lot of people think, but for some time, maybe it was seen as politically not correct to say that, but even that sort of norm seems to have eroded.
Mm. And so is the erosion of that norm happening more rapidly now because of the tenor of the political conversation nationally?
I think that has something to do with it. So our racial identities and our racial attitudes are so tightly wound up with a lot of people's political affiliations and political identities that it's almost hard to disentangle the two. And as we see more political polarization, that is also accompanied by racial polarization to some degree.
Mm. Well, so just to be blunt about it, in 2018, that tape from the sheriff, he talks about putting people away and basically locking up and throwing away the key and never even letting them out for recreational time. I mean, that is an extreme law and order stance. But right now, President Donald Trump is campaigning on law and order. I mean, do you see a connection between the two?
Well, it's interesting. You know, President Trump's decision to campaign on a law and order platform, initially he did that in 2016, and it seemed, you know, rather curious given that the United States was seeing actually record lows when it came to crime. Now, we could argue that this year there's been somewhat of an uptick and maybe it's more appropriate, but I think the fact that he has relied on similar platforms both in 2016 and now in 2020 speaks to the utility of that type of rhetoric and that type of messaging. It's almost disconnected from whatever the actual reality on the ground is in terms of crime, but that he can kind of use as a political tool this political boogeyman of crime and violent people coming to take over your suburbs and things of that nature. So I think he's using what he thinks is politically expedient, at least for some fraction of the population.
Mm-hmm. But of course, the law and order rhetoric used as a tool by politicians, the current president is not the first to have done that. I mean, this goes back across many presidencies.
Oh, certainly. So this dates back to, Nixon's Southern strategy and really using crime and also often welfare as wedge issues to basically attacked Democrats for being too soft on these issues and essentially too beholden to the racially liberal wings of their parties, and maybe even more so to their Black and brown constituencies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to play some tape about how members of the Trump administration and the president himself have been talking about these issues. First of all, here's Kellyanne Conway last week when she was still a counselor for the president. She was on Fox and Friends discussing the political implications, as she sees them, of the violence in Kenosha.
I also noticed there was a quote today from a restaurateur in Wisconsin saying, "Are you protesters trying to get Donald Trump reelected?" He knows full stop, yeah. And I guess Mayor Pete knows full stop, that the more chaos and anarchy and vandalism and violence reigns, the better it is for the very clear choice on who's best on public safety and law and order.
And here's the president himself talking about controlling violence last night in a White House press briefing that he gave. He was focused specifically on left-wing groups.
"We must strictly and fully enforce our law and have no tolerance for anarchy and no tolerance, zero, for violence. Anyone who breaks the law should be arrested, prosecuted, and punished. This includes targeting law enforcement efforts to focus on Antifa, the left-wing domestic terror organization. The mission of Antifa is to spread terror in the U.S. population with the goal of getting Americans to give up to their agenda."
President Donald Trump last night. Michael German, let me just turn back to you here for a second. What did you hear when the president made those comments?
A couple of things. I mean, one of the things that I found interesting was, you know, Antifa became this bugaboo term that during the period of time where you saw these far-right rallies devolve into violence, and it was anti-racist and anti-fascist groups who came out to oppose the far-right groups. So those were anti-fascist actions. But the Black Lives Matter protests since the murder of George Floyd have nothing to do with anti-fascism. And so I found it very odd that the president kept referring to Antifa as the provocation for the Black Lives Matter protests. And what I finally realized, it was simply because it was a bridge too far to blame Black Lives Matter for the violence. So it was a useful tool to argue without making it explicitly racist, but clearly, when we saw that much of the violence recently coming from the far right, that he actually praised that violence. I think it's just an attempt to manipulate these protests for political purposes, but it also has an inherent contradiction. You know, this idea that look how violent society has become, only President Trump can make it go away, seems to ignore that he's the president when the violence started and has increased. So what if he had the power to reduce it, you think he would be doing that rather than encouraging it?
Mm-hmm. LaFleur, if I can turn back to you for a second. A little earlier in the show, Michael German talked about how the president's rhetoric has effectively given cover for right-wing groups to be much more public, coming out into the streets, you know, as armed vigilante groups, etc., in a way that they hadn't necessarily done as often before. And I was just wondering, you know, what your thoughts are about that.
Well, I think after 2016, some people at least, were quite shocked and, you know, thought like, how could someone like this get elected? You know, essentially, he's engaged in a lot of racist rhetoric and not even so much dog whistles. And what I like to say is that, you know, President Trump, as powerful as he is, he didn't make anyone racist per se, but I think it's safe to say that he has emboldened many people, particularly some of those same right-wing militants to kind of speak what they were maybe thinking quietly, or it was seen as maybe incorrect to say that in public spaces. But if you have, you know, the head of the government essentially making these comments, then it's not surprising that others would feel comfortable. And also, if there's no sort of denouncement of that violence, that they would be likely to engage in that as well.
Mm. And to the president's pointing to Antifa as his target there in terms of the people that he is denouncing, just what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think Mr. German mentioned it earlier. It's a political tool, right? So Antifa is a buzzword on the right, and I think can incite fear and worries about, you know, taking down government, essentially, you know, for that sort of suburban housewife that he, President Trump, so often refers to. So I think he's essentially shifting blame and attention to a group that, you know, he sees as a political opponent. And he, I think, thinks he does best when he has an opponent, when he has a political foil. And for now, it's Antifa. But, you know, next week it might be more explicitly BLM.
Mm-hmm. So, Michael German, we've just got a couple of minutes left. And I want to circle back to something you said earlier, that there's no national strategy to deal with extremism inside law enforcement. And does that lack of national strategy actually put the American people at danger, but also law enforcement officers themselves? Because is there any guarantee at all that these groups that may be aligned or maybe support, you know, quote unquote, backing the blue right now will stay that way?
White supremacist far right militancy in law enforcement is a very serious problem for public safety. And as you said, for the safety of their own colleagues. I mean, it's fascinating that the president's rhetoric and the police behavior still seems to favor these far right groups when the two police officers killed since the George Floyd protests started were killed by far right militants, you know, specifically targeted and ambushed by far-right militants. So these groups, even though they're putting on this posture of being police-friendly, still remain a direct threat to law enforcement. And that's the part I really don't understand about what the breakdown is in law enforcement training and law enforcement intelligence, that the police aren't being trained, that these people are not your friends. And even if under President Trump, there's this common enemy, this imaginary Antifa. Just because they have the same enemy doesn't mean they're your friends. And as soon as the police start taking any kind of enforcement action against these groups, because they've had this space to organize and to recruit and to work on their tactics, they are going to be far more dangerous in the future.
Well, Michael German is a fellow with the Brennan Center and author of a new report, Hidden in Plain Sight, Racism, White Supremacy, and Far-Right Militancy in Law Enforcement. Michael German, thank you so much for being with us. And LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, professor of politics at Princeton University and author of Race to the Bottom, How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics. Thank you as well. This is On Point.